Yes. Can we have the music? I allow the body and the mind to relax. Allowing the body to settle down. I withdraw my attention from the world around me. Withdrawing my attention from the past, from the future. Withdrawing my attention from all bodily experiences and sensations. Beginning my inner journey. I go deep within. Deep within to the center of my being. To the center of my existence. I experience my entire existence concentrating, converging into a point. A point of light. A sparkling star. The eternal spirit. Shining in the center of the brain. Star in the center of the brain, that energy which was before this body was, that which will be after this body is no more. My original and eternal existence. Of light, energy. Silent and peaceful. It is as though this entire physical world and this physical body has disappeared. All that remains is light. And I see myself as a being of light. Just a sparkling star. silent, peaceful. And stabilized in this experience of my eternal self, I take myself beyond to that world of light that is the original home of the soul. And I see myself in the presence of the Supreme. I see myself in the presence of God. The eternal flame. The source of infinite being. Unlimited strength. It's sparkling like a star. And I, the eternal spirit, and bathing in this light. Letting this light flow into me. I lose myself in this deep silence. In this silent union between the soul and the Supreme. In silence, and holding on to this experience of blissful silence. This experience of spiritual pleasure, bliss, fullness, love. I allow myself to gently return back to this world of matter, back to this room, back to this body, this physical costume of mine. Once again, I take my place in the center of the brain, holding on to the deep stillness within, looking out through these eyes, listening through these ears. Silent and peaceful. At peace with myself. At peace with the world. There are also places in the front if you want. Please come. Good afternoon. Yes, so welcome again. The last time we met, we were speaking about anger, transforming anger, anger, irritation, all the various children of anger and the brothers and sisters of anger, right? We have frustration, irritation, all these things. Rage, the extreme form of anger. Today we will speak about transforming hurt and pain. In the previous session, when we were speaking about anger, we also spoke about how very often behind anger there is the experience of pain and hurt. And so if we want to transform anger, we have to necessarily look at the experience of pain and hurt and fear that informs anger, that influences anger, that creates anger sometimes. Anger then becomes a way that the soul is desperately trying to regain a sense of control, a sense of security, but that doesn't always work. We were speaking about these things in the previous session. Today we will look at these roots of anger, these roots that we speak about as hurt and pain. And I will also share some two cases actually that display this phenomena associated with hurt and pain. One is an organization, actually. Do you have organizational pain? One is an organization. It's an actual case study of an organization. The organization was diagnosed as having depression. The organization is going through depression. That was the diagnosis of the consultants. How does an organization go through depression? We will speak about that. And then the other is actually the case study of a Zen master, a pretty well-known practitioner of Zen meditation. He also was a professor in philosophy. Then he gave up his tenureship at University of Columbia to become a Zen monk. And then he went through serious depression. And then his understanding, and then how he dealt with that, and the various issues that it brought up. We will look at some of these things. Sometimes spirituality, meditation, we take up, but we may take them up sometimes for not exactly the right reasons. No? So we will look at these issues of motives behind our practice, whatever practice we have, whatever spiritual practice we have. What are the motives? governing our practice. We will look at some of these things today. So, we speak quite often of pain and hurt, right? So we say, there is pain, there is hurt. Very often we use them synonymously, hurt and pain, same, right? Potato, potato, it's the same thing. Is it the same thing? Or is there a difference between hurt and pain? Of course, experientially, it depends on what you are referring to in your mind, right? You can refer to hurt and say pain, and you can refer to pain and say hurt. It doesn't really matter. But we will try and differentiate between these two experiences. If you want, you can use different words for them. That's not the point. But what is hurt and what is pain? What is pain? Let's look at pain first. What is pain? What is pain? We have physical pain also, right? And then, of course, we have the inner pain, the psychological, the mental pain. What is pain? What is our experience of pain?
Suffering.
The experience of suffering. Then we have another word, suffering. So is pain the same as suffering? Of course. We use these terms synonymously. Hurt, pain, suffering, it's all the same. Spiritually, we look at different processes that are happening inside. They're very closely related to each other, but if we can break them down, sometimes it helps us. So we spoke about suffering, and in the previous sessions that we had this month, we spoke about some forms of suffering. For example, we spoke of, in the very first session, what is it that we spoke of? We spoke of anxiety, right? Anxiety and fear. So you have the experience of anxiety, you have the experience of fear, closely related to each other, but yet different experiences. In the other session, we spoke about anger, right? And irritation, and the other aspects of anger. Other forms of suffering, we know there is the experience of sadness. We have various forms of suffering, we know that. So, suffering coming from all these, or expressed in these ways, right? Suffering, the psychological state of distress. What is pain? What is pain? Suffering expresses in many ways, for example, this, right? There are also other forms of suffering. Other forms of suffering that don't appear to be suffering. Can you think of any forms of suffering that don't appear to be suffering? Yes?
I think of the various forms of addictions.
Addictions. And what is behind addictions?
I think that pain is behind
it. Pain is there, right? But in the addiction, the process of addiction, there is a craving, right? You crave for something. You crave for pleasure, basically. There is a craving for pleasure. There is a strong craving for pleasure. And that can, of course, sometimes take the form of addiction. Addictions that we know of and addictions that we may not necessarily know of sometimes. There are different forms of addiction. So we also have this sometimes a very strong craving for pleasure. In this way, when there is this strong craving for pleasure, very often we say that's a sign of pain. There is pain inside. And I want to experience some pleasure to forget that pain. The strong craving for pleasure. Along with that, there are other experiences. For example, passion. We have excitement. We have the use of force. You could say forced enjoyment or forced pleasure. I'm experiencing something empty inside. I want to experience pleasure. I want to experience pleasure. Force myself to experience pleasure. Take some substances, for example. Drink a lot. You force yourself. You force the body's chemistry to give you pleasure. See? Internally there is pain, and then you force yourself to experience pleasure. And these things sometimes we are quite oblivious of. We don't know what is happening inside. We just give in to that. We just give in to that. Something happens, you know, go out, have fun, have a party, watch some movies, read a book, meet some friends, talk to someone. Let's get out. And these, many times, we don't pay attention to. We will try and look at some of these experiences as well.
nothing wrong with having a party, right? I mean, that's a different story. But what are the motives informing that? What are the intentions behind that behavior of seeking something? We will try and look at that. So suffering, we know, is caused by pain. What is pain? When do we feel pain?
When there's something wrong.
When there's something wrong. What is that something wrong? Physical pain, when do we feel pain? Let's look at physical pain first, right? When do we feel physical pain? Any pain, yes?
When we get hurt.
We get hurt. There's some hurt. And what is this hurt? So we feel pain, so there has to be hurt to give me the experience of some pain. But what is this hurt? What happens in hurt? Yes, Yasmin?
Basically,
it's related to the body.
Physically, it's related to the body. But what is the experience of hurt?
I don't know what you mean.
Hurt. How is hurt caused? How is hurt caused? So I'm hurt. There is some hurt. There is some injury. And I feel the pain. The injury creates some damage. Some damage to the body. The body is not in its natural state anymore, right? The damage could be, of course, through some infection where the body is not in its natural state again. The damage could also be created by some excess. Working too hard or something like that. Work too hard, then you end up with a back pain. I had a terrible back pain in the morning. I was wondering, why is that coming? Obviously, I've done something wrong, right? Why have I done something wrong, sat wrong, something. There is some damage, some sort of out of balance, not the natural state that gives you the experience, that hurt, that damage creates the pain. So physically we understand this happens. Psychologically, of course, we spoke about these things in the previous session. We speak about this experience of some form of damage, and very often it's a sort of a perceived damage many times. There is the experience psychologically of some form of loss or some form of trauma. And then there is the perception. Here we move to the psychological experience of hurt. There is the perception of damage, perception of some loss, perception of some trauma. It leaves some sort of an injury inside. And then that injury smarts. There is pain. There is the uncomfortable feeling of there being something wrong. And then that manifests very often as suffering. And so when we have the experience of pain, coming back to psychological pain, the inner pain that we experience from loss, from trauma, it could be different forms of loss again. One is the real loss, say, of relationships, someone you love. It could also be the loss of respect, loss of love. And someone insults us. Someone says something nasty, we feel a loss of our respect, our self-respect. We feel a loss of love, whatever it is, different forms of loss and trauma. So what do we do when we have this experience of pain coming from this experience of some sort of loss, damage, some injury? What do we do? How do we respond in ways? Yes?
We try to take in.
Separate ourselves, that's what you mean?
I mean that if it's body is hurt, we take medicine. If it's psychological hurt, we look for a movie or we need to take something. We don't give.
One is, of course, as I said, okay, so I sort of pleasure. I try to get some pleasure, watch a movie, something like that. What happens when there are relationships involved? So a person has got hurt in a relationship, right? How do people, yes? We withdraw from that relationship. That happens quite often. Of course, there are many ways of responding, but one very common way of responding is this withdrawal. Why do we withdraw? So let's look at this. So the experience of pain is there. And from this experience of pain, I have one reaction, that is withdrawal. And so it could, of course, be, what forms of withdrawal could it be? One is physically, I separate myself. I don't see that person. I don't want to meet that person again. There is a physical withdrawal. Could there be other forms of withdrawal? What could be other forms of withdrawal?
Passiveness.
Passive, that we spoke about that in the previous session. Sort of a passive, aggressive withdrawal, where you are there in that situation, but psychologically you withdraw. You've withdrawn your love, you've withdrawn your commitment, you've withdrawn that. You were saying something.
Meaning ignoring.
Yeah, it could also be that, right? You could also say ignoring. So, of course, we have this withdrawal of various forms. It could be physical withdrawal. It could be a psychological withdrawal. And so we have, on the one hand, withdrawal from, say, the person who is associated with that hurt or injury. It could also be withdrawal from the situation. Now, this could be both a sort of a physical withdrawal, where I move away, I don't want to see that person anymore. I avoid. Because why do we do that? Why do we withdraw? Why do we avoid?
Protection.
Yeah?
Protection.
Which means there is a fear. I want to defend myself, protect myself. Protect myself, defend myself against what?
Feeling pain.
Sorry?
Feeling pain.
Feeling the pain. And possibly future hurt. So go back to that situation, meet that person again, there is a possibility of being hurt again. And so I protect myself. I withdraw from that situation. I withdraw from that situation. And so because, of course, I have the fear that I will be hurt again. And so the fear says, okay, now I don't want to be hurt again. And there is already this hurt inside me. There is a strong desire to forget. I want to forget. I'm sorry. I want to forget the situation. Because it is too painful, the hurt is there, then there is the fear of being hurt again, and therefore I just want to forget all about it. Forget about the situation, forget about the person, just move away from that whole thing, right? How well does it work? We all know how well does it work. But the question is, are we able to identify when we are withdrawing from the situation? So I'll give you an example of one form of withdrawal from this company that I spoke to you about, right? So there was this organization, and they were having financial difficulties. And when organizations have financial difficulties, when their customer base is going smaller or thinner, profit margins are being pushed, one of the common ways that organizations resort to is to lay off people, right? You fire some people, you reduce the organizational size so you can protect yourself. It's a form of protection, of course. You can rationalize, you can justify that. So this organization was going through a financial difficulty. And then they decided, well, if we have to survive, then we have to fire. We have to let some people off, lay some people off. At the same time, you have been working with these people for a long time. Right? You're working with these people for a long time, and you have the organizational reality that you have to let some people go. It's not very easy, right? It does create pain. Where does this pain come from?
Loss.
Sorry?
The loss. From loss.
Loss. There is a sense of loss. What else is there in the sense of loss? Yes?
Attachment.
Attachment to people. Yeah, that's true. But still, you know, I mean, there are also other things. I mean, these people are depending on the job to support their family, support themselves. Of course, if you're in Denmark, you get your A-Kassa and whatever content yet. But you don't get that in many countries, right? You lose a job, period, end of story, you're on your own. Yeah. So there is also this understanding that these people need the job. And if they lose the job, then what's going to happen to them? And yet, I am responsible for letting them go. Yes, yes.
It is also when you're different, you know, differentiation between some people. You choose that these 10 people have to go, and
yeah,
these 10 people will stay.
Mm.
And that could create some hurt.
What does it create?
Guilt.
Guilt. There is also this experience of guilt. Another source of hurt and pain, right? The guilt. These people, I mean, I've always told they are my family, we are responsible for each other, and now I have to let them go and create difficulties. I remember my brother, he heads HR in a company in India. And during the financial crisis, soon after that, they had to lay off people. And he heads HR, so he was responsible for that. He was responsible for that. And he used to speak to me quite frequently those days because it was so painful. It was so painful. Imagine friends you're working with, who you've gone out to a party with, you've shared many intimate things with, who has been a support for you, who you've been a support for, and suddenly not because the person's performances has gone down in any way, but because that product the person was responsible for, there is no demand for that product anymore. There is no demand for that service anymore in the market. or some other competitors are offering that same product for a cheaper price, so people don't want to buy it from you anymore. And the guy has done so well, the company has progressed because of that guy, and you have to go and give the letter to the person that, sorry, but we have to let you go. That's very painful. So what happens when we feel guilt? We also had a session on shame and guilt, right? So what happens when you feel guilt? It's very, the feeling of guilt is very painful. One way of dealing with guilt is you push it out of your consciousness. You feel it, it's very painful. The other way is forget about it. Push it out of your consciousness. And one way that people try and push it out of our consciousness is also the sense of force. Of course, it is not the kind of an enjoyment, but it is force. What happens? There is this experience of guilt and it's very painful. How do I take responsibility for this? And yet I have to do that action. So what happened in this company was they decided to lay off. And the way they executed that layoff was very, very strange. But it's understandable, but it was still very strange for the people who were laid off. So what would happen was, the people who were responsible for the layoff, they did their strategic analysis of which positions are not required, which positions are required, which positions will give us some competitive advantage, which positions, you know, they just will not contribute in any way. So let's get rid of them. So they decided that. Now this whole process, you can imagine, is very painful. Because the soul, however nasty the person may be superficially, the soul inside is a being of love. And I'm creating difficulties for others. That creates guilt. How am I dealing with that guilt? I want to forget that guilt. So these people decided how we are going to execute the layoff is a person was made responsible, or some people were made responsible for going and contacting the people sitting in the office. And so a person would walk up to a person's desk and say, well, we had a meeting and we've decided that we have to let you go. And you have 15 minutes to clear your desk. And then the person is waiting there for 15 minutes till the person clears the desk. And then a security person comes in, takes this person, escorts this person out to his or her car. This is the way they decided to execute the layoff. Now, why on earth would a company do that? Why on earth would a company do that? Yeah? That's crazy, right? Yes.
They don't want to lose information, then they don't trust the person.
That's the thing, mainly it's data protection. The company was dealing with highly classified information, yes?
I would say it was maybe because they don't want to see the person cry and having a hard time because then they feel guilty.
Could be, also. But it could very well be a mixture of both. In this, the case of this company, there were issues. They wanted to protect the database. They didn't want the person to take all these things out. But one can also argue that, you know, one way that in many organizations management tries to deal with guilt is you distance yourself from the people. This sort of a withdrawal, which is also a sense of distancing. And the sense of distancing somehow justifies the action. In my mind, it justifies the action I'm doing. I'm engaging it. It doesn't really help. But it pushes the guilt away. The guilt is still there. And to justify my action, I would sometimes use force, extreme measures, because then employees are the problem. I'm not the problem. My action is not the problem. They are the problem. And sometimes justify that, people could engage in some very strange, ruthless, tough behaviors. That toughness is a facade that is hiding the guilt and the pain that comes from guilt. Yes?
It also shows very much that how we human really treat each other. We tend to believe, we should believe in the good and people, but we believe in the bad and suspicious way that they will do all this.
Yeah, but that is coming from my own suppression.
Yeah.
I am suppressing and denying my natural experiences, the natural experiences of the soul of concern, of love. I have concern and love for these people I am firing. But there is a frustration because I can't do anything with that love and concern. And so how do I? It's very frustrating. And so one way is split it off, push it away, forget that I have any guilt, but this has to be done. Make yourself tough. This has to be done. And then you justify it anyway. So this happened in the company. And so now, obviously, every day, the anxiety in the company was increasing because people were being laid off. And people are being laid off. The others were thinking, maybe it's my turn next. And whenever this person, these people who were responsible for going and communicating it to the employees, they would walk in the corridors, there would be high anxiety, actually, right? So the company went through this. After that, after the period was over and people were laid off, all the people who were supposed to be laid off were laid off. The company should have started performing well, but it didn't. Because what happened then in the whole organization was people just withdrew. Because of their hurt. So first you have the managers, the management withdrawing from their responsibility towards their employees and withdrawing from their guilt and engaging in a behavior like that. Then you had the other employees feeling their hurt because now what have I done? What have these people done? My friends who stayed in this company for so long, who gave so much to this company, they were let off, okay, but in that way, that was very, very, very painful. And that hurt and that pain, and so there is anger. There is anger and there is sadness. There is pain of loss creating sadness. And then that is frustrated, coming out as anger. Anger cannot be expressed very clearly because then they are afraid of losing their jobs. So they can't voice that anger clearly. It goes into passive mode, passive aggression, where people just find ways of sabotaging the work of the company. They commit, they don't perform. They're not being helped, the company is not being helped. But they know they can't fire everyone. They need people to do these, perform these functions. But I will not perform these functions because I'm angry against the company. So nothing was really working. And so then these guys hired a few consultants to come in, some psychologists came in, they did their interviewing, and then they diagnosed the organization with depression. Organizational depression. What happens in depression? You withdraw from the world, right? You shut off from the world. Isolate yourself from the world because you're afraid. People are afraid of going out there and feeling the pain, confronting the pain again. It's too much. You withdraw. And so everybody withdrew in the whole organization. Withdrawing from people, withdrawing from the situation. That didn't really help. Right? And then, of course, these people came in. Then they started talking to everyone. Then they spoke to the management, gave their diagnosis of the organization to the management. The management began to understand these psychological processes behind that behavior that they were seeing in the organization. Then, they went out. They had this... So one is this desire to forget the pain and the hurt, which of course doesn't work. We know that very clearly. And then, of course, the other is the acceptance, the awareness. We have this other process of the actual awareness. I need to be aware of what I have done and the feelings I have experienced myself. Management began with being aware of that. And then, of course, I'm aware, and then there is the desire not to forget, but the desire which we speak about spiritually as the desire to transcend, the desire to go beyond the hurt, which requires awareness. If the awareness is not there, obviously I cannot do it. Then these people went out somewhere, they took these people in groups, they went out to a nice mountain resort, they sat around the fire and they talked. That's all they did, they just talked. And as they started talking, all the anger, all the pent-up anger came out, all the emotions came out. Then the management came in that group, and so no one would speak when the management representatives were present. Then the management representatives started speaking about their guilt. There were experiences of people crying from the management because all that guilt was pushed away. And now all that guilt came up. And then they started crying in these meetings with these people. They started crying and spoke about how sorry they were for what they did. But they did not think of any other alternative at that point in time. When these people saw the management expressing themselves and crying, then they softened. Then they slowly started working together. And then the company could actually come out of that situation. So this is one example. Forgetting and moving away. And so in our own behavior, how does that manifest? That is something we have to look at. If I am withdrawing from the person, from the situation, that is, I believe, the source of this hurt, what is it doing to me? How is it helping? Because I'm basically going away. I'm not getting in touch with my inner self. I'm running away. So one is running away from the person and the situation. And the other is withdrawal from the self. This can be very, very tricky. I'll give you this other case of this person, quite a well-known person, Lewis Nordstrom. So he was PhD in philosophy, University of Columbia, and tenure track position to become a professor of philosophy. And he got very interested in meditation, was always very interested in meditation. So he started practicing some form of Zen meditation. And he had wonderful experiences in meditation. Wonderful. You know, highs. People have these highs in meditation sometimes. It's too good. It's fantastic, it's wonderful. So he had these lovely experiences in meditation. And then he said, okay, now this is my life, this is what I have to do. This is what I have to do. He gave up his 10-year track professorship at Columbia. And he decided to commit himself to a life, a monastic life. He became a monk, basically a Zen monk. And he became a very well-known Zen monk because he had that scientific background, philosophy, mathematics, logic. At the same time, the understanding of spirituality from the Zen Buddhist tradition. And he was practicing and feeling great, and he was able to communicate that feeling of greatness to everyone. So he was a very popular teacher as well. But after many years of having lived that kind of a life, he found himself going slowly and slowly into depression. And there was no reason for that. He said, why? He couldn't understand. Everything was fine. Yes?
But withdrawal is not always a bad thing.
Yeah, we'll speak about that as well. Now, if you answer all the questions, Miguel, what do I do here? I have to justify my existence here, right?
Sorry.
We'll come to that.
Yes.
Right. So now we're speaking about the other side of withdrawal, right? Then we'll speak of the other form of withdrawal. So anyway, so where was I? Yeah. So he was, after some time, he found himself getting into this depression. He felt well, maybe. And then he started getting frustrated and discontented with his monastic life. That same life that gave him a lot of pleasure before became a source of claustrophobia. He felt he had to break out, break free. It was too much for him. And so he left that life, went back to his old life of being a teacher. Of course, now he was a bit old, so he couldn't get into a university in a full-time position. But he started doing some part-time teaching. He was very intelligent. He was very clever. So he managed to get some teaching assignments in big universities like Yale, Columbia. He started teaching, but he was scraping through, just living. Then he got married once, got divorced. Few years, got married again, got divorced. Few years, third time got married again, got divorced. Few years, fourth time got married again, and a disastrous divorce. And after the fourth divorce, it was just too much for him. He couldn't understand, so he had left his life, he had taken up this life of a monk, and that became frustrating. He came back to his old life, and that became frustrating. And then he tried many things, everything was frustrating. So he was in a very deep and dark state of mind. And then he decided to take therapy. Imagine a Zen monk going for therapy. Right? But he decided, now I need therapy. And he ended up in a psychoanalyst's office. And then they started talking. Of course, first he was very resistant. You know, I know spirituality, I know everything. What is there to talk to these people about? But sometimes we know, but we are not aware. We are not clearly aware of what's happening inside. We can be very good at telling others what's happening. Right? Because it's so painful here. Anyway, so he went, and then in the process of the dialogue that he had with the psychoanalyst over many weeks, slowly some memories of the past started re-emerging, started coming out again. And this man, Nordstrom, he had had a very painful relationship with his mother. Very painful. He felt that she had abandoned him. And he met his mother later on, sometime in his life. But that sense of having been abandoned was very, very deep. And with that sense of having been, because she never took care of him, and I don't recall the exact details, but I think she was having problem with alcohol, things like that. So she was never there for him. And that sense of abandonment was very, very deep. That sense of abandonment, having been left aside, thrown aside, discarded, rejected, and that hurt that he was carrying with it. And so initially, the escape, the withdrawal from that situation, from that problem, was perform. Perform in his studies, do very well. Perform, he used to play basketball, perform in sports, you know, this sort of force I'm using on myself as though this I'm escaping from something, you know, there's a fantasy, something will make me escaping. Nothing wrong with playing nice basketball, right? And nothing wrong with getting good grades. That's a different story, but the motive here is this desire to forget the self. The self itself is painful. And meditation then became a very convenient tool to forget the self. Because meditation is about forgetting the self. And the whole Buddhist philosophy, selflessness, you go beyond the self. Self is an illusion. Perfect. Because the sense of self is so painful, I want to forget it anyway. So the whole thing became perfect for him. But of course, it's a wonderful and deep philosophy, forgetting the self. But what is the motive behind that? So for him, the forgetting of the self is forgetting the pain, suppression in a way. Here we are not speaking. Here what we are speaking about is basically the experience of suppression. I'm not forgetting. I'm not pushing anything away. I'm just suppressing it. And so for him, those experiences of meditation were wonderful. Because in those moments, he could forget that pain. Right? And so that's what he wants to do for the rest of his life. But because the pain cannot be forgotten, it can be repressed, it can be pushed away, but if it has not been dealt with, if it has not been confronted, if it has not been faced, it cannot go away. It will come out in some other form. So for some time, until he could keep all that pain and that hurt suppressed, he was fine. Or at least he told himself that he was fine. But then that is boiling inside, that is growing inside, and at a point in time it was just too much. And so he would try and control, but then it would become frustrating because all the energy of the mind was being invested in pushing these experiences away. There was no experience, no energy left to actually experience the spirit. Everything was being used to push, keep these things pushed. They're trying to come into the surface, keep them pushed. That's frustrating. And so he finds himself getting very frustrated. He leaves that life, comes to another life. And now he's having relationships with women. And every woman he has a relationship with reminds him of his mother. Or reminds him of that perceived experience with the mother. Now, a lot of things we deal with are perceptions, right? If you remember once I'd spoken about this young girl, she went out with her father to a market and met her father's friend. The father's friend said, "Oh, she's such a sweet girl." And the father said, "You want to take her with you? You can take her with you." And that led to such a deep trauma, that fear of being abandoned, that continued for a long, long time in her life. Distrust of men. No, otherwise the relationship with the father was very good. It was so loving. And because it was so loving, maybe, there was such a big fear of losing that relationship. It's a perception. The father did not, obviously was not wanting to abandon her in any way. But it's a perception. So very often we are carrying such perceptions from the past. We take them to be reality. And our entire life is then constructed on that constructed reality. And then coming to face to face with it is very, very painful. But anyway, whatever happened. So he would enter into a relationship with the mother and the fear. Right? The fear of being rejected, the fear of being abandoned. So before you abandon me, I abandon you. I don't want to abandon you, but I want to abandon you. I want to abandon you because you will eventually abandon me, I know that. And I'm not confronting that fear. I'm not facing that fear. I have just taken. And then I either do something to defeat my whole purpose of being in that relationship. I engage in behavior where I'm pushing you, and then I want you to come close. I'm testing your love. Do you love me? And so I push you. I say hurtful things. I say nasty things. So obviously, after some point in time, the person will take a holiday. And then in the same pattern, that problem has not been resolved, take it into the next relationship. And then the person does not have any solution to that. And as he sat in therapy over many, many weeks and months, he slowly started revisiting those experiences of having. And you know, the extreme, one very amazing experience happened at that time. This desire to forget the self can sometimes take very extreme forms when you wish death upon yourself. Of course, the soul cannot die. We know that. But we don't know that clearly when we are trapped in all the suffering and pain. We just want to leave. We want to forget. One way to forget is to just commit suicide. For him, it wasn't suicide, but it was very, very interesting what happened. So he was living in a small apartment, and there was a shared bathroom, shared toilet, right? So he had to get out of his apartment and sort of walk down a few stairs, and then there was this toilet he was sharing with people from another apartment. And so he woke up in the night. Now, by this time, he was quite old. He was around 60. So he woke up in the night and he wanted to go down to the toilet. And the thought came in his mind that, the stairs are there and it's dark, I should switch on the light. And from inside the thought came, I don't want to switch on the light, forget it. And then he went. And the next step, he fell down. He fractured his leg, it was a terrible injury. He survived, he didn't of course die. That shook him up again a lot. Then he went back when he could to the therapy, and then they sort of worked through this event. And his experience, of course, again, these are his subjective experiences, but his experience was that when he worked through that experience, it was like a death wish. I should switch on the light for my own welfare. I don't want my own welfare. I don't want to live. You've sort of given up on life. And he sort of gave up and he said, just forget about it. And then he has the accident. It's like calling something upon yourself, punishing yourself, hurting yourself. That was his experience of that understanding. And that really shook him up. And then he sort of worked through his experiences over a period of time. He went back to his practice of meditation. And so for him, then he's written many things. Now he's doing quite well. But he spoke about how it is so important to balance the practice of meditation, for example, with a very clear awareness of what is happening inside the self, however painful it may be. Because the escape will not work. I have to be aware. I have to be aware. There is, of course, the desire to transcend. You spoke about withdrawal is not always bad. Can you give me an illustration?
You're fighting, having an argument with somebody, and you just feel like you're getting crazy in your head. So you just say, okay, I have to take a break. And you go like 5 minutes, and you're just like reminding yourself who you are, and this is not good. So you try to go back then.
And here we are dealing with knowledge. We are dealing with knowledge, and what we speak about here is, one is the experience of withdrawal, and the other is the experience of facing the situation, facing the pain, but for actually facing it, I need, in fact, to withdraw, but from a different perspective. Here we speak about a spiritual withdrawal. This is quite different. In fact, some of you who have done the Raja Yoga meditation course, you will remember, the power to withdraw is actually a spiritual power. But it's a different kind of withdrawal. We need withdrawal. We need withdrawal. When there is so much of pain and hurt, we need to withdraw. But what kind of withdrawal? Moving away from the person and situation? Sometimes, as you said, that can also be useful. But is that withdrawal then through understanding, knowledge, or is it out of fear of being hurt again? When I have the knowledge and the understanding and I know I need some time out. But then when we speak of spiritual withdrawal, yes?
Can it be both? Does it have to be one
or
the other?
No, it can be both. But the issue is, am I aware? Sometimes it's also a question of understanding my own capacity. Ideally speaking, I should be there and you insult me and say all sorts of things to me. It makes no difference to me. Ideally, that's how it should be. But I should also be sensible enough to understand whether that is a reality for me at this point in time. And if it is not, then the chances are I can be in front of you, but because I am in pain, I end up saying nasty things to you. And then I make the situation worse. Because I have not assessed my own capacity honestly. So sometimes you're right, I may need to actually move away from that situation for some time. But again, with the desire to transcend, I want to go beyond the hurt. I don't want to forget the hurt. I want to go beyond it. I can't forget it. It's not possible. When I go beyond it, it will appear to me as though that is not that important. And we call that forgetting and forgiving. But the thing is, I have gone beyond it. And so we say the spiritual withdrawal is a different story, where I am not withdrawing from the person or the situation, where I am not withdrawing from my sense of self. I'm not doing that. What I am withdrawing from is, I am withdrawing from the hurt and pain. I am withdrawing from the ego. This is what I'm withdrawing from. And this withdrawal, very often we say, it's like the opposite of facing. It's like a bow, right? These two opposites. I face and I withdraw. I face the situation, which means I'm fully engaged with the situation. Where we speak very often psychology, people speak of this construct of hardiness, resilience. It's very popular these days, resilience. Right? What makes us tough? Hardy, tough, which of course doesn't mean becoming rough and nasty to people. But there are three important elements of that psychological trait of hardiness. One is challenge, The second is control, and the third is commitment. And so when we speak about the power to face, actually we are speaking about one as challenge, which means basically the experience that I am having of hurt or pain or whatever it is, I perceive that as a challenge. How do I see that as a challenge? I see that as an opportunity for growth. And here lots of spiritual knowledge that we speak about can be very, very useful, because when we speak about everything having a purpose, we also say that if something terrible has happened, there is a sense of purpose in that. Can I understand that sense of purpose? This is using that situation for my own inner spiritual growth and development. Can I see the challenge in that? Can I see very clearly what challenge is brought to me spiritually? How I can use that situation to make myself strong? The second, but this challenge needs to be balanced again by this sense of control. And the sense of control is, I have an experience of mastery over the situation. That is, I exert control over that situation. What does that mean? I'm feeling fear, I'm feeling anxiety, I'm feeling hurt, and I'm feeling pain. If I am able to, yes.
But it's not always good to have control, because then there's...
Let's look at what am I speaking about? What do I mean by control here? Here I'm not speaking about controlling people and things like that. Here when we speak... Now the problem is, these same words are used for so many things, right? But here when we speak about control, what I'm at least referring to here is my sense of mastery over the situation. So if I'm feeling hurt and pain, if I'm feeling anger and I'm feeling rage, am I able to transform that emotion? If I can transform that emotion, I am in control. That's what I mean. Okay. I regain control. I regain mastery over the situation. And so this is something I have to do to transform. Yes?
I just have a question. Can that also be like a practical thing? If you know that you have a problem in certain situations and you found a way to like deal with it by doing like some very practical things, like bringing something or like...
Of course.
Okay.
How do I exercise control? For example, it could be something very, very simple. This is something many times we use with, let's say, clients who are having depression, don't want to do anything at all. Then we say, okay, you don't want to do anything. So they don't want to have their shower, they don't want to cook, nothing. To completely withdraw from the self, from the world and everything, that doesn't help them. And if you tell them suddenly, hey, return to your work, you know, it won't work. So what do? You start with baby steps. So today, you will get up and go for a walk. Just one small thing, practical thing, that gives you a sense of control over yourself. You're actually able to do that. Today you have a shower. Today you cook your food. Small things. So it could also be. But again, with the understanding of a very clear awareness of what you are doing and where it is coming from. Control. Taking this process deeper spiritually. Here we are speaking about control, where lots of things happen to me, I cannot control them, but I can control my responses to them. I can control my emotions. And when I exercise control at that level, I regain mastery. And then that is what we speak about as facing. So challenge, control, and the third is commitment. And this is engagement with the world. Not running away from the world. Engaging with the world. To whatever extent practical. So for example, it could be a colleague at the workplace who has said or done something very, very nasty. Right? Do I continue to engage with that person? If I don't, I'm losing control, because then that person is controlling me. That person's behavior is then controlling me. And if I take that as a challenge, and I work on actually engaging with that person on my terms, not allow that person's behavior to influence my emotions, not only I regain control. And this regaining of control is through my engagement with that person, with that situation. And therefore, I can experience strength. This is the experience of facing situations. But at the same time, it's not so easy. And therefore, I need to balance this facing with that spiritual withdrawal. And this is the first thing we do in meditation, right? You withdraw yourself from the situation. You go deep within, connect, and then this is where we have the utility of the process of yoga. But it has to be balanced with awareness. So now, I can also do yoga. I can try and do yoga through suppression. Like, for example, in the case of Lou Nordstrom. And I can try and do it with a sense of very clear awareness and knowledge of what is happening inside me. The same behavior of meditating, but informed by two very different sources. If it is informed by this source, guaranteed, yoga will become a source of frustration for us after some time. Guaranteed. I've seen the case of Lou Nordstrom, but also I've seen it in the case of my own self. Initially, I remember a lot of force. I wanted to become perfect, right? Spiritual and perfect and peaceful and all that stuff. And so, but you're doing it out of a sense of anger. Forced anger. You know, you want to forget. You want to forget all the crazy stuff you've done in your life. You want to forget all the guilt. Just forget about it. Forget about it. So one way to forget about it, go and party and whatever, have fun and do all those things. Another way is a spiritual way to forget about it. Meditate and feel good. In some time, it leads to frustration. And now I can clearly understand when I find the frustration coming, I know where it's coming from. I'm not doing something right. I'm not doing something right. I'm running away from something. I'm not confronting problems and situations. And it grows up over a period of time. I can see it. Say, for example, we have a talk now, Sunday evening. Go back home and I have some work to do. And suddenly I say, let's watch some television. There must be a movie coming on television. Let's watch some television. Now, anything wrong with watching a movie? No? Where is it coming from? Where is the desire to switch on the television coming from? Is it coming from the space of dissatisfaction? Is it coming from that space of emptiness? I want some entertainment in life because I'm not being entertained inside. In this sense, then, the craving for that pleasure becomes a symptom of some pain. And if I can catch that situation very clearly in my awareness, oh, something seems to be happening. If there is a compulsion, there is pain. If there is a compulsion to achieve, I have some pleasure, there is some pain. What is that? Where is it coming from? And then, I may not be able to identify those exact events now. You would say, then what, go to therapy and find out what all happened in the past? No, not required. I mean, you can do it if you want, but not required. All we need to do is understand that there is some pain. We may not remember the specific experiences, and I would say it's not always necessary to go into the specific details of all the experiences of the past. Sometimes it's just like going and digging and digging and digging and digging and dressing up dead bodies and playing with them. Sometimes it becomes that game as well. But instead of that, if I can withdraw deep into my spiritual self, go beyond this physical reality that I find myself in deep yoga, connect to God, stay in that experience, and we speak in such moments, I have seen for me what works beautifully. Focusing on three experiences. One is, of course, the experience of peace. So when we speak about that, we say the experience of deep stillness, silence, peace. Even when we have a physical injury, that injury needs to be kept, first of all, clean and still, right? It needs to be still. Leg is fractured, needs to be still for some time, till it heals. When it's healed, then you can do various things with it, right? So when I'm experiencing pain in various forms, and I know that there is pain inside, first I have to go and experience that experience of deep silence, going beyond the body. Going beyond this physical body, physical world, going into that world of light in deep silence. And then, the other is the experience of love and compassion. Firstly, towards the self. Loving the self. How do you love the self? You can't love the self, but you love the self. Some people say, how do you love the self? But the experience of love itself and the experience of deep compassion, understanding of your own suffering, that's compassion. Passion is suffering. Compassion is the understanding of suffering. No? You know this, right? We've spoken about this passion, the passion of Christ. It's not the excitement of Christ. It's the suffering of Christ. From the time he was captured to the time he was crucified, the passion of Christ. There's a movie on that suffering. Passion is actually a very clearly, I see, passion is a sign of suffering. Excitement is a sign of suffering. Identify that I am suffering. have compassion, have mercy, go deep into the self, experience pure love. And when we have the experience of love and peace, silence and love, love is healing. We need to heal because these injuries, this needs to heal. And when I have the experience of love and peace together, and then they have the experience of what we speak about as bliss, these three experiences together are extremely important for our experience of healing. Peace, deep stillness and silence, love. We all know what love is, right? Feeling the deep love and bliss. This is a quite often misunderstood under word bliss. It's pleasure, but it's not the superficial pleasure. You know Epicurus, the Greek philosopher, Epicurus, who spoke about pleasure all the time. So people misunderstand his philosophy completely. Because he said pleasure is the highest good. So we have many restaurants that are called Epicurus. That's where you need to experience pleasure, right? Nice, tasty food, sensory stimulation. You feel good. But Epicurus, he spoke about a state of pleasure. I think the Greek word is atarexia or something like that. Vasa? Do you know this? Vasa is from Greece, so she knows all these words. Atarexia? Do you know this word? It is pleasure, right? Anorexia? Atarexia? Something like that. Never mind, you look it up. You look at Epicurus' philosophy. And what he speaks about then is a state of bliss, which is a state of profound tranquility. Not ephemeral pleasure.
Avexia.
What's that?
Avexia?
What? Avexia? Avexia maybe, something like that. Something. Exia at the end and A in the beginning. Fill up the middle. So something like that. But actually his philosophy was the pursuit of ephemeral pleasures actually prevent the human from experiencing that aphexia. The experience of deep tranquility, which is real pleasure. And it is the absence of this pleasure that makes me pursue pleasure in the world outside. Forced pleasure through sensory stimulation, the various forms of excitement, infatuations, falling in love, all these things. Try to fill myself up, escape from the pain. Yes?
When you're in the nature and you see a sunrise and you feel a very spacious feeling, is that bliss?
No. Because, I'll tell you why, that is something coming from the outside in. And the very fact that nature has this power to transform our feelings shows that deep inside we are not feeling that good. And of course it's wonderful to go out in nature and feel that peace and feel that, but this is the bliss coming from the experience of peace and bliss, whatever it is, coming from the outside in. That will give us temporary relief from our situation in which we are, but it doesn't really heal. Because healing requires work.
But it feels like it's healing.
Yeah, it feels good. Lots of things feel like healing. If you inject yourself with some nice substances, you feel so good. But nothing wrong. By the way, sorry, I'm not equating nature with drugs. Of course, it's wonderful to go out, take a walk. And right now it's nice and cool and fresh.
But it's the same way some meditation they have where you meditate that you're in nature and it's the way that gives you peace.
Yeah, exactly. It does give you peace, but that is not the peace that is generated from my own power. And if I want to heal, if I want to transform, I have to draw on my own power. And Raj Yoga meditation specifically makes a very clear distinction. In fact, as we keep repeating this again and again, meditating by listening to music or commentary, that is not meditation. Sorry, that's not yoga. It's a tool I use. But I have to develop my strength, which means I have to use my thoughts. Very common, often repeated example, I want to develop this muscle. She takes my hand, puts a dumbbell on it, and she lifts my hand for me. How much strength will I develop, really? She's doing all the work for me. How much strength will I develop? So I feel bad and I go and I look at a nice scene of nature. I feel so good. Yes, I feel good, but what have I done? I've done nothing. I've just gone and sat there. That's passive. Again, please, it's wonderful. I enjoy nature. We all should enjoy nature. That's a different story. But that doesn't heal. Yes, that can help in creating the space inside for me to work on myself. So, of course, I can go into a beautiful, lovely scene of nature because that then supports me. That gives me the environment. But then that environment has to be used in going deep within and working on myself. And in that way, it would probably help. Yes?
What about guided meditation? They are saying you have to think like this and that, but that's not helping you either because you are not yourself saying the words.
Yeah, exactly. So now, for example, I'm guiding. That's all illusion, right? No, that doesn't really help. Again, as I said, these things are useful as tools to support us, but I have to do the work. And so sometimes, I remember having these experiences myself when I began meditation, I used to use commentaries, right? So the commentaries help me in withdrawing from the world. And then I am sort of left with myself. And then I have to work with myself. So I can, of course, use these supports, but eventually I have to work with myself. I have to generate my own energy. I have to use my own energy to develop this muscle. Then it becomes stronger. And this is the process of healing. I have to work on drawing out the experience of love. I have to work on drawing out the experience of bliss. I have to work on myself. It's not that difficult. It's possible. I just have to work on myself a little bit every day, and that should work. And then I have the experience of healing. But just the experience of yoga is not sufficient. I have to be engaged with the world. These two things have to happen simultaneously. My spiritual withdrawal deep within into myself and connection with God. At the same time, my engagement with the world. And this balance creates the healing. Because I have to test my power. I have to go out there and test it. So this person who's been nasty to me, can I engage with that person in love? When I do that, believe me, try this out. When I do that, there is the experience of such deep inner strength. Then something has healed. Then you know something has healed. Because you're able to feel love for that person. And you're able to transform that. Then you know something has healed. You have healed. You've helped the other person heal. And you've made a very beautiful relationship. Does it make sense?
Sure.
It's not Greek, sorry. But you're the only one who speaks Greek here, I think. Or Latin, whatever it is. So the transcending of hurt and pain, one, I would say, requires a clear awareness of my own motives. What am I doing? Whatever I am doing, what am I doing it for? Very clear awareness of my motives. But not just that. Along with that, this very clear practice of the power to withdraw spiritually. I'm withdrawing not from situations and people. I'm withdrawing from the pain and the hurt. Because the pain and the hurt comes from the ego. So I'm withdrawing away from my ego into the depth of the soul consciousness. And then I connect with God. Where I have the experience of that deep bliss and love, the soul begins to heal. And then I engage with the world. So Raja Yoga is also called Karma Yoga. Because it is a yoga that we need to practice in the world. The power and the engagement. Outside and the inside. And then with time, I know that the soul begins to transform, there is healing, there is transformation, we are able to overcome and transcend our hurt and pain. After some time, you will have this experience, if you practice this, you will have the experience, you will remember, the memory will be very clear. That person said this to me, the memory will be there, but the memory will have no effect on me. This is mastery. So this is what we call forgetting spiritually. It's not that the memory has gone, and sometimes you may even forget about it, because it has no importance anymore. But first, I have to experience that experience has become not important, unimportant. It's okay, doesn't matter. And there I have transcended. There is no suppression in work, and therefore I have a sustainable experience of peace and moving on. Initially, I have to confront that, I have to face it. Yes? Any questions or any things you would like to say? Michaela, anything you would like to say? Additions, subtractions? Yes?
Can you not be addicted to pain or addicted to feeling pain or holding on to pain?
Oh, of course. There are so many people who have this habit of mutilating themselves also sometimes, right? I remember I had a client once, he used to keep pinching himself. Pinching, and he would bleed and he would keep pinching himself. So yes, you're right, that also happens. But then I've seen, like in the case of that person, that pinching is like distracting attention from something else that is even more painful. In that case, it was some experiences with his mother. But whatever it was, I'm running away, and that is pulling me so much, I need to do something desperate to distract my attention from that. And so I do something else which pulls my attention. So like that, yes, but I have to be aware, otherwise it's very difficult to transform. Yes, okay.
So what about if a person you have chosen hurt you very much, do you recommend to stay in contact and have this relationship?
My recommendation would be I have to make a very honest assessment of my own capacity. If by staying in touch with that person I'm only going to make myself the victim, or I'm going to say and do nasty things which will make the relationship worse, then perhaps it's best that I take some time out. That I have to make an assessment, practically. But if I have the confidence that I can deal with that situation, and I can transform that person, I can transform myself, and nothing will, you know, make me change my inner sense of peace, then yes, I can stay there, and I can transform myself, I can transform that person, I can do that. But I need to have a clear assessment. It can be done, by the way. If you're asking that, it can be done. I know, I've done it.
If
I speak from my experience.
You have the power of your soul to bring in...
You can do it.
With peace and forgiveness, you can...
You can do it, but we have to be realistic.
Yeah, but you're healing yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the ideal thing would be to stay in that... Because that situation has come to me for a purpose. Mm-hmm. It has come to me so I can grow.
Yeah.
But then how do I use it to grow? Mm. If I can't, then maybe it is best that I take some time off. This is an assessment.
But it's my experience. It will just be coming back and
you
back
are
and back.
100% right.
One more person that is doing the same thing.
Yes.
Again, again, again.
You're right.
If you're not totally go into forgiveness and to this person.
Yes, you are right.
Okay.
That is what will happen. You're right, because that becomes an escape, and then because the pattern has not been solved, it will keep repeating itself.
Yeah.
And so that is not a permanent solution. But sometimes we have to be practical and also take a temporary solution when we are clearly aware that we would really like to work on the permanent solution. So yes, ideally speaking, I should see that situation, face it, confront, finish it right there, right then. That would be the best thing to do. Okay, now we have, and then we have to have some meditation. So yes, Michaela?
I have two questions.
Two questions.
I don't know how many people here meditate, but the word bliss, I don't think I actually have experienced it.
Welcome to the club.
Okay.
There are many people in that club. I also used to be in that club, but now I can say I've experienced it.
Okay, and the other question, I think
yes.
It's really hard to get a balance between the spiritual withdrawing and being with the world and people around.
Yes,
I
you're right.
Many times I feel like out of balance.
It is one of the most difficult things.
Okay, so I'm not crazy then.
Welcome to the club.
Okay.
It is one of the most difficult things. But then again, you know, it's a question of experimenting and finding our balance. And that's why it's very important for us to take out some time every day to do the spiritual withdrawal, but also engage with the world. And then you find it too much, then come here, and then go back, and then come here. And with time, slowly, we settle into a natural rhythm. Yes? Yes?
Why does bad emotion grow? Can you say a few words?
Why do bad emotions grow?
Yeah, because, well, when you forget it and don't give it any attention, why does it grow anyway?
Yeah, it's because... I am not forgetting it, I'm suppressing it. It grows if I'm suppressing it. If it is growing, that means I am suppressing it, I'm not working on transforming it. So if I suppress something, the pressure will increase, right? That's why it grows, simple. And so if it is growing, I must recognize that I'm not dealing with it correctly, I'm just suppressing it, and then I need to probably look a little deeper. And one way, of course, is to go into this deep spiritual withdrawal, and experience that experience of peace and stillness and love, and then maybe come out and look at that issue. But that's why it will grow. Katrina, you were saying something?
No, well, it was kind of the same thing.
Same thing, okay. So shall we wind up with some meditation to wind up today? Our next talk will be actually on October 20th, where we will look at self-determination. This whole going this process further, self-determination. How do I determine my own emotions? Are my emotions determined by myself, or are they determined by someone else? Are my actions determined by myself or determined by someone else? There is also some very fascinating research these days in psychology on self-determination, going so deep, it's almost spiritual. but it's scientifically tested and statistically evaluated and all that stuff. So I would like to speak about some of that as well in the next session on October 28th. But for now, we have a little meditation. Turn my attention away from this external world of activities, responsibilities, experiences. I withdraw deep within. Center of the brain, the soul, the spirit, the source of all life and consciousness. The center of love and peace and bliss. I experience as though this entire physical world and this physical body has disappeared. All that remains is light. I, the soul, a spark of infinity, a being of eternity. See myself beyond space and time in a world of light. And I see myself once again in the presence of God. The ocean.
rest in silence. Lost in the experience of deep silence. Experiencing super sensuous joy, the deep pleasure of fullness. The absence of desire, nowhere to go, nothing to do, just be the eternal spirit in the presence of the Supreme. Body, this costume of mine, and once again I take my place in the center of the brain, looking out through these eyes, listening through these ears, silent and peaceful, at peace with myself, at peace with the world.
Tak for i dag. Tak for i dag.